entrepreneurs and workers can bring their ideas to evolve into products, careers, or businesses, building a culture of innovation and diversity in the heart of Itasca County. Learn more at theforgeitasca.org, where ideas take shape. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy skies, lows 41 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
5 journalists were killed after 2 Israeli strikes on a hospital in Gaza today, putting the death toll for media workers there in just the last 2 years at nearly 200. We'll hear from the CEO of the Committee to Protect Journalists.
And Area Man insists on printing out whole website. A year ago, the satirical publication The Onion restarted its print version, and it's been a surprising success. The editor peels back the layers for us on what makes a hard copy Onion so appealing.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
It is 6:01, and you're tuned in to As It Happens, a CBC program here on member-supported KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Oak Hill Assisted Living in Grand Rapids, providing personalized care in a home setting. More information at oakhillseniors.com. On the River is our volunteer-hosted mix of folk, rock, jazz, blues, and world music on KAXE 7 days a week. Trained community members choose the music every weekday at 1 and 7, plus Saturdays at 4 and Sundays at 1. Big thanks to our dedicated volunteers. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. And Grand Rapids Riverfest is Saturday, September 6th. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and info at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. And if you want to volunteer at the event, head to GrandRapidsRiverFest.com under Get Involved. Now I'm going to play a tune for you from one of the artists they'll be performing. This is Margot Price with Mind Travel.
Traveling in my mind.
And that's Margot Price with the song Mind Travel. You can catch her at Grand Rapids River Fest Saturday, September 6th. Get your tickets at grandrapidsriverfest.com. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
the fourth estate on the front line. Several journalists are among the dead after Israeli airstrikes on Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. That means nearly 200 media workers have been killed in Gaza since 2023.
Revisiting the visit, a Canadian-Ukrainian dual citizen living in Kyiv shares his reaction after Prime Minister Mark Carney makes a surprise trip to Ukraine.
On their guard, D.C. students went back to school today as armed National Guard troops patrol the city. One parent tells us what she's doing to keep her children safe in the newly militarized environment.
An ay-yi-yi for an ay-yi-yi. A California Democratic state senator tells us why her party is responding to Republican redistricting tactics, first by decrying them and then by matching them.
Not that hard copy. It's been a year now since the satirical publication The Onion returned to print, and it's been a lot easier and a lot more successful than anyone imagined.
And putting the smoking in Smoking Gun, a South Korean fraudster might still be ripping people off if he hadn't attracted police attention by throwing a cigarette butt away in the wrong place. As It Happens, the Monday edition, radio that warns you can bust your butt only for your butt to get you busted. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says it was a tragic mishap, but Al Jazeera says it's part of a systematic campaign to silence the truth. Five more journalists were killed in Gaza today. An Israeli strike hit Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, and minutes later, as rescuers and journalists rushed to help the wounded, a second bomb hit in the same location. At least 20 people were killed, including the journalists who worked for various organizations, including Al Jazeera, the Associated Press, and Reuters. The Committee to Protect Journalists estimates that 197 media workers have now been killed in Gaza since the war began in October 2023. Jody Ginsberg is the CEO of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We reached her in New York.
Jody, the news on so many fronts is relentless when we're talking about Gaza. When did you get news of this deadly strike?
So I learned of the strike first thing this morning, US time. It came as a real shock, particularly on top of the killings 2 weeks ago of six journalists in a tent in Gaza City. And this one was particularly shocking for a number of reasons, including that it was a double tap strike on a hospital in which five journalists were killed.
What was happening at the hospital?
So my understanding is that the journalists, like journalists throughout Gaza, have been reporting on the casualties coming into Gaza and also the effects of the enforced starvation on the Gazan population. They've been reporting on that, so they were there doing that reporting. Journalists are stationed throughout Gaza close to hospitals because that's where they can see the impacts most clearly for many people on the war. So it's not uncommon for journalists to be based close to or around a hospital.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the journalists we're talking about, like all of the journalists there, are not only the eyes and ears of the international community on what is unfolding, but they're also living the starvation, the airstrikes, the attacks as well. The journalists were Hussam al-Masri, Mohammed Salama, Maryam Abu Daga, Ahmed Abu Aziz, and Moaz Abu Taha. Maryam in particular, the Associated Press, quotes from a recent Facebook post, one of her last, talking about her life there. She wrote, quote, "When you see the soil covering the most precious thing you have, only then will you realize how trivial life is," unquote. Had any of these journalists, Jody, reached out to your organization for help?
To my knowledge, not directly. They weren't among the journalists, for example, that we know who've been subject to smear campaigns by the Israeli army. Obviously, they are known to many of us through their reporting. But I think what you say is really important to remember. When people think about war, they often think about war correspondents in the sort of traditional sense of foreign correspondents being parachuted into a place, you know, helmet and flak jacket. And what we have to keep reminding people over and over again is these journalists are not war correspondents because that's the path they chose. They are war correspondents because that is the reality on which they are reporting. War has come to them. They are reporters and they are reporting what they are seeing every day and also living through it. They have no opportunity, as foreign correspondents might, to leave, to get respite, to get medical treatment in the same way. They are day after day experiencing the deprivations, the impact of war, and reporting on it.
What can you tell our listeners of what you know, what you've been able to learn about these five journalists today?
Well, what we understand is that there was initial strike on the fourth floor of Nasser Hospital in a stairwell known to be a stairwell used by journalists for filming. What we believe may have happened is that initially there were reports that Israel said it was targeting a camera that it believed to be operating by Hamas. We know that Reuters was streaming from the building. Their cameraman was hit and killed in the first strike. And then there was what I referred to earlier as this double tap strike, which is essentially when there's an initial attack, first responders go in, and then there's a second attack. The Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, later said it was a tragic mishap. This is an unusual admission of guilt and responsibility from Israel, but it, you know, really downplays the gravity of the situation. You know, a mishap is when I spill a drink. It's not when I kill 20 civilians.
The name of your organization says it, you're the Committee to Protect Journalists. So as these deaths keep coming, these killings keep coming, as we've said, close to 200 media workers killed since October 2023 in Gaza. 189 of them were Palestinian. How are you and your team dealing with this relentless reality?
It's completely heartbreaking. We've been calling out this situation, the unlawful killings of journalists, the unprecedented nature of the killings, the deadliest conflict for journalists since CPJ has been documenting attacks on journalists, for nearly 2 years now. And for much of that, we were met with what felt like an almost deafening silence, very little solidarity shown from international media and other journalists, almost no reaction from the international community, and certainly no willingness from Israel to conduct any investigations and to hold anyone accountable. So it can often feel like screaming into the void. We are continuing to do the work that we can by documenting what's happening so that we have the evidence. But ultimately, responsibility lies with Israel and the international community.
Is anything changing in terms of that lack of response and solidarity that you're feeling and seeing?
I think we're beginning to see a shift, both from the international community, that's been happening over some time, and now from governance. The mood is definitely shifting, but it can't shift fast enough because journalists continue to be killed and civilians continue to be killed at an unprecedented rate.
So what about the journalists who are still working there? How can you keep them safe?
We cannot keep them safe. What we can do is continue to call for their protection, to speak out very loudly when these incidents occur, and to encourage governments to take action. We're not allowed in. We can't provide direct assistance. International journalists still do not have access, and that's one of the clear calls that we are making, is for there to be international access. And then, of course, we need accountability and justice.
Jodi, I very much appreciate your time. Thank you for this. Please take care.
Thank you.
Jodi Ginsberg is the CEO of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We reached her in New York. Tonight, students across Washington, D.C. are home after their first day of school. And for a lot of families, the usual jitters about new teachers and class schedules are overshadowed by the fear of running into federal agents. Hundreds of National Guard troops have been patrolling the streets of Washington for the past 2 weeks since U.S. President Donald Trump declared a crime emergency in the district. As of yesterday, some of those troops were carrying firearms, marking an escalation to the military deployment. And Mr. Trump is threatening to expand the crackdown to other cities led by Democratic Party politicians, including Baltimore, Chicago, and New York. Marta Urquilla is a D.C. resident and mother of two teenagers. She and other parents have been banding together to organize carpools and walking groups in their neighborhood. We reached her in Washington, D.C.
Marta, how did drop-off go this morning?
It was without incident, thankfully. And we've been hearing reports from other communities, other schools in the city that they also largely experienced no incidents. For our kids, it was peaceful. You couldn't ask for better on the first day of school.
It says a lot to me, just listening to how you framed what you said there. You know, you were all bracing for really the worst, it sounds like, or for anything to happen.
Yeah, and it's just the first morning. There's still the after-school release and the rest of the week. I know that there were some metro stations that had ICE agents standing at the turnstiles this morning and watching students as they passed through. You know, definitely it wasn't perfect everywhere, but there was a strong showing of parent and caregiver and community support. People got very creative in making signs and, you know, standing on intersections and corners. And, you know, there was a lot of beeping from, you know, the metro bus drivers and other cars. So I think that, you know, people were definitely wanting to turn out in support of kids today.
How did you prepare your children for this? They're in their teens, 14. You have a 14-year-old and a 17-year-old. So what kind of conversations and preparation was going on in your home before today for them?
Well, my kids are biracial. And so if you see them, you will know right away that one of their parents is Black. They present as Black. And we have had conversations about interacting with the law before, especially after George Floyd. I taped up on our front door as you're walking out the door, just a flyer that, you know, kind of goes over the fast, you know, things to know, like you have the right to film, although under 18, we don't encourage them to do that. Mm-hmm. You have the right to ask, am I free to go? You can say that you do not consent to a search, just like those points for them to just, as they go in and out of the house, they're seeing the signage so that it can just start to really lock into their memory for them. And first just reassuring them that, you know, we would be driving them to school and reminding them that we could take friends of theirs and neighbors as well because we have the room. So for us, it's just that's a safer option, and we're not taking any risks. My eldest, one of her classmates who lives in our neighborhood, was stopped as she was driving home from an appointment. And I think that really just kind of shook that circle of friends to realize, you know, these are like young drivers. They've been driving for less than a year or a year or so. That's a really scary experience. And our situation, while we have reasons for concern, like it's not the same as others in our community. We have parents who can't walk their kids to school on the first day because they're so afraid. One of our fellow parents, she took her neighbor's kids to school this morning. And, you know, a 10-year-old girl was saying to her, like, thank you so much. My parents are too afraid to leave the house right now. And it's just heartbreaking because the first day of school, it's such a joyful time and you want to get those pictures. And, you know, I just can't imagine not being able to accompany my kids on that day.
And on that issue of feeling safe, the White House, as you well know, has said this is all about making D.C. safer. You've lived there for a very long time. How would you describe the situation there in terms of safety, crime, security, all of that?
I mean, I've lived in the district for over 30 years, and I do remember times back in the 90s, especially, and in the early 2000s, where there was a lot of crime and a lot of violence, and when you did not feel safe. You know, when my daughter was a newborn, I remember hitting the floor in our living room because of a drive-by shooting that happened right outside. And, you know, 30 bullet casings found in the neighbor's yard across the street. And with a regular occurrence, we were hitting the floor in our house. And those were scary times for sure. You know, this is a city that came through the crack epidemic, right? Like, there's really different times, and the city is in a different place. I mean, crime peaked in the pandemic, I would say, but it has been feeling much better. It feels predatory. And, you know, I couldn't ever have conceived that my neighborhood would be organizing to have a buddy system to accompany people on our streets.
What the White House has done feels predatory, to be clear. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the activity, the traffic stops, the checkpoints, the patrolling, you know, FBI agents in the bleachers at a rec field while a rec soccer game is happening, you know, seeing people being pulled out of their cars or people being harassed at the metro.
So is this, I mean, are you bracing for this to be your reality or your children's reality for the school year now?
I don't believe the 30 days, and I don't believe the 45 days. And I think if we look at Los Angeles, we see that that's exactly the case, right? They're still in LA after first going in back in June. And I think that that is concerning. I think that, you know, he called out Chicago, New York City, and now Baltimore, and then he's called out 19 states. You know, there is something here that is, you know, much more than about keeping people safe. And I'm very concerned. We're all very concerned. So I don't think this will go away quickly, but I do know that people who live and have been longtime residents and native Washingtonians are not going to let this happen quietly. We love our city and we want to defend our city and we want no federal occupation.
Marta, I appreciate your time. Thank you for this. Please take care.
Thank you so much, and thank you for covering the story.
Marta Urquilla is a D.C. resident who is organizing carpools and walking groups for families in her neighborhood. She's in Washington, D.C. Across the United States this morning, people in housecoats shuffled out to their front porches and their slippers, blinking in the sunshine, and picked up their newspapers to be greeted by the headline, "Family members locked in heated bidding war to convince cat to sleep in their bed." The newspaper is The Onion, the publication that's been satirizing the news since launching as a campus paper in 1988. A decade ago, it went exclusively online. But a year ago, it returned to its roots and revived its print edition, a gamble that has been surprisingly successful. Jordan LaFleur is the executive editor of The Onion, and we reached him in Chicago.
So, Jordan, what is your dream headline for The Onion becoming such a success in print?
Oh, that's a tough one. I mean, I feel like with it's a rather unexpected scenario that we find ourselves in. I feel like it's got to be something like a good thing happens or positive development questions. Yeah,
definitely. I hear what you're saying. This would be the hope, though, right? But it sounds like you and the team are surprised that you're here a year later.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I won't bore you with the details. I'd rather focus on the present and future, but my staff and I, rather, have extricated ourselves from a former ownership that was not giving us very positive feelings. I guess I'll word it that way. We're in an ascendant place that just a year and a half ago was very unexpected.
And there's no joke there, really. Leadership matters wherever you are. You're a leader, obviously, as managing editor. But what have the new owners said and done to get you to this place?
I mean, really what they've done is just empower us. I feel like what we've done in the past year or so is to execute a vision we've long had. You know, a return to print, a de-emphasis on old business models that simply don't work. And by that, I mean an overdependence on banner ads on websites. You know, I'm happy to continue powering theonion.com. It's an important place for us as a brand, but to depend wholly on a website to generate the revenue necessary to support us and the brand writ large, was outdated thinking. And so new leaders have done an excellent job of, you know, surveying the current media landscape, recognizing that we needed to generate revenue from directly from our readers rather than depending on a website. And long story short, it's working.
And what else is different, apart from it coming out once a month, in the print edition?
I guess first I would just emphasize that the experience of consuming The Onion is just improves a lot when the context is The Onion itself. And by that, I mean, as opposed to within the social media context. Mm. You know, I'm proud of the work we do. I'm proud of each and every joke we publish, for the most part. And the experience of consuming it on social media is just pales in comparison. We have a lot of jokes that benefit from adjacency to other jokes. It provides a contrast that in and of itself can be amusing. So to have this kind of like closed space, a closed room to enjoy The Onion is just a much better way to consume it.
The team, the creators behind it must love it.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, you know, we our paper archive is here in the office with us, and we like to flip through them ourselves. And it's just, you know, the website is an important component of the brand, but for it to be the lone component was just a very myopic vision of The Onion and the brand. And so, yes, to be back in print is a joy.
So $99 a year, right? You get a tote bag, I think, too?
That's correct. If you buy now, you get a tote bag. Head to theonion.com. You'll see banners for it everywhere.
And do you see, I mean, it sounds like because things are going well, I don't know, maybe I'm just guessing from the tone of your voice that you might expand, you know, print more than once a month?
Whoa. Once a month is work enough. Are you signing me up for more work? We recently expanded to 24 pages. And so, yes, okay. There is now more of The Onion within a single edition. So we have just expanded as of last month's issue. But for the time being, we'll keep it at once a month. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Understood. you know better than most that tumultuous times, difficult times even, are certainly fertile ground for the kind of work that you and your team do in satire. What is this particular moment, not just in the U.S., but around the world, like for you and the team? Is it easier? Is it more difficult?
You know, satire is an ancient art, and these unsettled times that we live in, unfortunately, are not all that unique. I mean, there are unique components to it, of course, but these are not the first unsettled, turbulent political times in the history of the world. So the tools of satire are robust. They are consistent. And so we just simply continue to use them regardless of the era that we live in. The second layer of truth I can offer is that it is, in fact, hard to satirize a government, a person, a man who conducts themselves in such a heightened way. And so I think it makes it incumbent upon us to comment on the cast of characters around him. I'm alluding to Trump without saying his name. I don't know why I'm pretending like he's Voldemort. But yeah, commenting on Trump can be difficult.
Last year, I believe it was The Economist, they wrote, for a publication devoted to teasing newspapers, returning to paper is the ultimate troll. If The Onion succeeds, the joke will be on everyone else fleeing the format. Do you feel like it's the ultimate troll?
The truth is, I am rooting for traditional media. I think, you know, as a consumer of news, I need better journalism. We, to be a functioning society, need access to good, honest, truthful reporting. And so, and I also recognize, having worked in traditional media myself, that the failure of these organizations to find a business model that better sustains that effort is a problem for all of us. So while it is fun to work for one of the very few ascendant print products, I think it would be a better world for all of us to live in if there were other media brands having the same kind of success.
Really great speaking with you, Jordan. Thanks for this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Jordan LaFleur is the executive editor of The Onion. We reached him in Chicago. Dateline, Seoul, South Korea. When a true master criminal is stopped by police, they will enact a series of sly subterfuges. They'll be cool. When asked for ID, they'll produce an expert forgery. As soon as the interaction is over, they'll dart around a corner and dramatically peel off their lifelike latex mask to reveal another lifelike latex mask. Well, in many ways, an unnamed South Korean man is a master criminal. He was wanted for allegedly orchestrating a cryptocurrency scam in which he defrauded 1,300 people out of the equivalent of $18 million Canadian. But the police didn't know that when they approached him. They just knew that he had littered by tossing his cigarette butt. So he knew that if they figured out who he was sunk. So he deployed a brilliant strategy. He begged them to let him go. Very cool. But for some reason, his dramatic plea only piqued the officer's interest. So he tried a second tactic. When they asked him for ID, he cleverly said no. Now, ordinarily, that's a slam dunk. The police will just shrug helplessly and say, nuts, you got us. You're free to go. Inexplicably, not these police. So he tried another brilliant gambit. He pretended to take a phone call. Again, ordinarily, checkmate. The police aren't allowed to bother you while you're on the phone, and yet even that didn't work. Now, in this situation, Hugh and I would start hyperventilating inside our lifelike latex masks, but the unnamed man unveiled his ace in the hole. He offered the officers money to leave him alone. But no dice. Somehow, despite this tour de force of coup de grace, they arrested him. This evil crypto scam mastermind, undone by a simple act of littering, his whole magnificent life of crime up in carelessly discarded smoke. Gowan with A Criminal Mind.
Oh, I'm sorry for everyone who didn't get to hear Chris singing live along to that off mic. We are going to take a short break now. When we return, a Canadian in Kyiv tells us what he thinks of what Prime Minister Carney is promising Ukrainians.
We'll also hear about California's efforts to beat Republicans by joining them in gerrymandering, and about the lengths bears will go to get the ice cream they want and the weed store dumpsters that it turns out they don't really want.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
It is 6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, CBC program here on KAXE, KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, Marie DeBrie. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information available at mndeerhunters.com. And we receive support from Beltrami Electric, building an all-of-the-above energy strategy that combines the diverse strengths of sun, wind, coal, and water. Beltrami Electric Cooperative, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy skies, lows 41 to 45. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs 71 to 76.
Yesterday, Prime Minister Mark Carney surprised the world by visiting Ukraine on its Independence Day.
We must deter and fortify. Deter Russia from thinking that they can ever again threaten Ukraine's and Europe's freedom.
It was the Prime Minister's first official visit to the war-torn country, where he met with President Zelensky, outlined the details of a $2 billion aid package, and did not rule out the idea of sending Canadian troops to a post-war Ukraine. Thousands of Ukrainian Canadians in Canada and Ukraine were listening. Mykhailo Winitsky is a sociology professor at Kyiv Mohyla Academy and the former deputy minister of education in Ukraine. He's originally from Kitchener, Ontario, but chose to stay in Ukraine with his wife and four children when the war started. We reached him in Kyiv.
Professor, this was Prime Minister Carney's first official visit to Ukraine. Did you hear what you needed to hear, what you wanted to hear from him?
I think so. Look, we've become accustomed in Kyiv to high-level Western visitors. And actually, we appreciate them arriving because every time they do arrive, we tend to have a decrease in the number of air raid sirens that go off. In other words, the Russians tend to avoid sending missiles and drones our way when there's high-level Western visitors in town. So we appreciate the fact that that Prime Minister Carney was here. He announced, obviously, a fairly not large military aid package, which is obviously appreciated. And there is a significant amount of aid that's coming from Canada to Ukraine's war effort. There's a lot of skepticism here as to the prospects for peace, and a lot of people have making a very big deal of that, President Trump's initiatives, etc. I think Prime Minister Carney was, less headstrong than other leaders that have come into the country.
What do you mean by that?
I think that there's a lot of optimism that is being put out as to the ability of the United States to broker some sort of a peace deal. A peace deal requires the aggressor state to be interested in a peace deal. And at this point, it's becoming very, very clear that the Russians are... don't even single out Putin. I think it's the Russians in general. The Russian establishment is not interested in any kind of a peace deal with Ukraine. The interest is in continuing this genocidal war and basically making sure that Ukraine, either best case for them, becomes a puppet state. The ideological goal is to make sure that Ukraine ceases to exist as a separate identity.
So you think Prime Minister Carney wasn't as... bold in signaling that an end could come quickly, just that help would be there.
Yeah, I think the statement of we're not ruling out Canadian troops on the ground at some point in time was obviously well received and appreciated. But at the end of the day, that promise does in fact require some sort of a peace deal at this point. And we've heard multiple statements from the U.S. president about ending the war in 24 hours, ending the war in 2 weeks, ending the war in 2 months. At this point in time, in order to end the war, the Russians have to be interested in ending the war, and they're certainly not interested. It's a meat grinder on their part. They're losing literally, they've lost upwards of a million soldiers at this point. They're throwing everything they can with limited gains territorially. And the Ukrainian side is obviously gaining in strength at this point with our Western friends, with our European friends. Canada is playing a significant portion or a significant role in that. Part of Carney's trip to Ukraine was also a tour of certain military, basically an exhibition of the military hardware that is currently being produced within Ukraine. And this is drone technology as well as rocketry and other stuff that, quite frankly, is changing the way that wars are fought at this point. And obviously, Canada, as well as other NATO countries, are interested in that technology. So it's a two-way street.
As our listeners heard, you're a dual citizen. You have children who are not only dealing with you know, what you were and so many others in Kyiv and across Ukraine are dealing with, but... what kinds of conversations are you having about Ukraine's future?
My background is that I'm born in Canada, but I've spent 23 years living in Ukraine. In the last 2 years, I've actually held the government position as Deputy Minister of Education, responsible for higher education. Just finished that that little term of service literally 2 weeks ago. So they see Dad as being someone who serves in whatever way that's possible. And we have three students in the house, three university students, and one young lady that's just finishing up her schooling. Our two older kids are involved in various ways in the war efforts. One's involved with drone technology, the other one's involved with tactical medicine. It's a funny thing when you're under an existential threat, and when the aggressor state is basically saying you have no right to exist, people band together and do things to make sure that we will continue to exist. So I think it's a collective effort on many of our parts. My wife is very keen on making sure that our children are safe on the one hand, but on the other hand are also very much involved in everything that is going on in the country.
So short of an actual deal, what would you and your colleagues, your neighbors, your family need to hear from the next world leader who visits or from the next summit to actually believe that the next Independence Day is going to be different?
The point is that in order to have a peace, the person that is responsible for the aggression and the regime that is responsible for the aggression needs to come out and say, we're done with the aggression. And that's not a Western, the West has not been attacking Ukraine. It's Russia that's attacking Ukraine. So at this point in time, we need to strengthen Ukraine. We need to be strengthening the defense capacity of Ukraine. We need to be strengthening the society here. And obviously, we've been receiving a lot of help. We're very grateful for that. President Zelensky is regularly thanking everyone that he can thank for all the help that is provided. And not just him, I think we all do that. And I think that one of the things that's happened also globally is that we've become, as Ukrainians, we've become a very much sort of a global nation. There's as many Ukrainians at this point living outside of Ukraine as there are living in Ukraine, including 1.5 million Canadians of Ukrainian origin. So the fact that we're a global nation makes us very proud of our territory, because the territory is really the place that that is home for everybody. So there's 600,000 square kilometers of territory that we call Ukraine, and that's home for anybody that considers themselves to be Ukrainian. So what do we want to see in the next Independence Day? We want to make sure that 600,000 square kilometers of our home is in fact our home.
Thank you for this, Professor. Please take care.
Thank you.
We reached Canadian-Ukrainian sociology professor Mykhailo Winitsky in Kyiv. Twenty years ago this week, Hurricane Katrina made landfall on the Gulf Coast. The catastrophe that followed is still vivid in the minds of the people of Louisiana and everyone who saw the stunning images. People clinging to rooftops, entire neighborhoods submerged, highways washed away. More than 180,000 homes were destroyed and nearly 2,000 people died. In the aftermath of that storm, then Army Lieutenant General Russell Honoré became the face of the recovery effort as the commander of Joint Task Force Katrina. In 2025, of course, storms are stronger and climate disasters have become more frequent. And when Russell Honoré spoke with NPR's Michelle Martin, he talked about how the lessons learned from Hurricane Katrina are more relevant today than ever.
Imagine 15,000 or so people standing outside the Superdome, then getting off that helicopter and making eye contact with people and that look of desperation in their eyes to get out of there. And it broke my heart when I saw a lady with a toddler in a shopping basket pushing the baby in the water. The water was up to the baby's chest and she was trying to get into the Superdome to save her baby and herself. And I said, we got to get these people out of here.
Had you ever seen anything like this?
Nothing of this magnitude. Over 240,000 homes flooded in and around New Orleans.
How did you decide what to do first?
Well, I listened to the priority of the mayor, and I left the mayor and went to see the governor, Blanco. Her priority was evacuation, provide food and water for people. This obviously was a logistics issue.
The memory that a lot of people have is that there were too many people in leadership positions that were seen as incompetent. In hindsight, is that fair?
we have to take into account, when you have a major disaster, first of all your first responders are survivors. The storm overmatched the infrastructure, and it overmatched the ability for them to deal with it, because in a real crisis, the local leaders lose control because it's beyond the ability to immediately respond to. That's why we've got these levels of government and federal organizations that need to be prepared to go in and help people.
Is there something that you think emergency response leaders have learned from Katrina or should have learned?
Yeah, that you can't skip the preparedness phase. In the preparedness phase, if you're going to put people in a shelter, they have pre-positioned food and water. But what changed their entire quick response to create those shelters was the fact when the levees broke, people couldn't leave, and they were run out of their homes, and they were on the top of the interstates.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them were still on their roofs days later. And the people on the ground, there were people working their you-know-what off trying to save lives.
If there's a lasting legacy of Katrina, what do you think the lasting legacy is?
It's a reminder that on any given day, Mother Nature can break anything built by man. And when we get proper warning, we need to evacuate. And we need to be prepared to evacuate.
Former Army Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, one of the leaders of the Hurricane Katrina recovery effort, talking to Michelle Martin on NPR's Morning Edition. Donald Trump has changed the game, so Democrats in California are adjusting their rulebook. Last week, Texas lawmakers approved new congressional maps designed to favor Republicans in congressional elections. The maps were redrawn at the request of President Trump in an effort to guarantee Republican control over the House of Representatives. Now, California Democrats have responded in kind. Late last week, lawmakers there approved a plan to elect more Democrats by redrawing the state's congressional districts. California Governor Gavin Newsom has been quick to point out that Mr. Trump and the Republican Party struck first.
He plays by no rules. I remind you all the time, it's not the rule of law, it's the rule of Don. And we're standing up to that. We're responding to that. They fired the first shot, Texas. We wouldn't be here had Texas not done what they just did. Donald Trump didn't do what he just did.
The new California map is not a done deal. Voters will have to greenlight it through a November ballot measure. Sabrina Cervantes is a California state senator and the chair of the Senate's Elections Committee. We reached her in Sacramento, California.
Senator, as you well know, people across your party are condemning Texas Republicans for gerrymandering their congressional maps. But is the approach in California really any different?
Well, we know that this is not politics as usual. This is a rigged game, and this is a national emergency, which is why we responded accordingly last week when we passed the Election Rigging Response Act into law.
Are you concerned, though, that there's hypocrisy there and people will see it that way and that it will further potentially erode trust in the process?
When the federal government is sending masked federal agents into our communities and snatching people off the streets indiscriminately and slashing health care for millions of working Americans and handing billionaires tax breaks while slapping working families with taxes on everyday essentials, this is where our communities are facing every day. And they're saying no more. No more to the overreach, no more to Trump's power grabs. And this is why we had to fight fire with fire, as Governor Newsom has stated. California is at a point where we are trying to save our democracy, not just in our state, but in our country. And we believe this is the right response.
California's congressional maps, for listeners who aren't aware, are drawn currently by an independent redistricting commission, and that's to make sure districts reflect correctly the population of the state. Jean Raya is a former member of that commission. She spoke about the redistricting plan last week. We'll play for you and our listeners a little bit of what Ms. Raya had to say.
I'm a registered Democrat, always have been. and I would celebrate replacing any congressional member who has forgotten his or her oath to represent their constituents and protect the Constitution. But this can't be at the expense of the California Constitution nor the California voters who mandated fair, nonpartisan redistricting. California set the gold standard for redistricting. This is not the time to take a step back from innovative democracy.
What do you say to those who agree with Jean Raya there? You know, she doesn't support Donald Trump, but also doesn't want to see changes or anything messing with the integrity of these maps as they stand now.
But our approach is much different than Texas. What we are doing is giving the power back to the voters of California so they make the ultimate decision on whether we draw these congressional districts to protect fair representation. And this is only on a temporary basis. In order to counter what Texas and other red-led states are doing, which is partisan gerrymandering. At the end of the day, our state constitution allows us to go back to the voters of California, and that is what we're doing on November 4th, and I strongly believe that voters will say yes, yes to allowing this mid-decade redistricting to occur, and this is how they get to push back and fight back against these rigged midterms that Texas and other red states are doing.
Republicans in your state have talked about the potential costs, saying that this ballot measure could cost California taxpayers upwards of $200 million. If that figure is accurate, do you think voters will hear what you're saying and actually accept that kind of price tag?
We believe that this cost is certainly going to be as much as Trump's new ballroom that he's building at the White House. But I will say to those voters that, you know, the Republican Party had no problem spending $200 million on the failed recall attempt of Governor Newsom. And so I believe that was irresponsible of them to do in 2021. We are here protecting fair play in America. So what is the cost of protecting fair play in America? I don't believe it's nothing compared to letting President Trump cheat our country.
Some Democrats in California, and you may be one of them, have suggested that if Texas were to change course here, if it were to back down on its plans, that you would do the same in California. Do you have a sense that any change like that could actually come?
We've spoken to a number of Texas legislators who visited California on two different occasions. And it does not seem that they are backing down. In fact, they're speeding up their efforts, just as we saw last week. But we do have a clause in our legislative language that states if Texas or any other state does back down, we will be done. We will keep our current districts as they stand today. But if any state does move forward with mid-decade redistricting, this is our response to it.
How would you characterize whether that might happen or not? Are you hopeful at this stage?
No, we don't believe that they're going to change course. We believe that they have every intention to move forward. As we all know, Trump called Governor Abbott and demanded 5 seats. He's not asking them. He's demanding them. And that is the type of playbook that they are going to do in other red-leaning states and why other Democratic-leaning states are looking to respond just as we did last week.
State Senator, I appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
My pleasure.
We reached State Senator Sabrina Cervantes in Sacramento, California. Bears. Big, cool, cute, unapproachable, and hungry. And it might seem that they'll just eat whatever you put in front of them, from a big raw salmon to yourself. But sometimes they can be very determined to get one particular type of food. For example, not long ago, a California bear decided he wanted ice cream. And I know we all wanted ice cream not long ago, but the bear actually decided to break into an ice cream shop in South Lake Tahoe and climb over the counter to get it, which is how El Dorado County Sheriff's officers found Fuzzy, as he's now called, and they were only able to lure Fuzzy out of the shop by offering him more ice cream. That is a lot more than what another, no less determined bear got when he broke into a weed dispensary in Lyons, Colorado a few years ago. From our archives, here's Nico Garza at the Bud Depot talking about that bear break-in.
So the bear ripped through the fence, tore it open, then proceeded to try and get into the dumpster. And when he couldn't get into the dumpster, he started moving it around. Next thing you know, he's spinning around in circles with it. And he drags this really heavy dumpster out into the parking lot and then proceeded to drag it a few yards all the way across the parking lot before he, I guess, gave up and tried to find something a little bit easier to eat.
Now, you told one reporter that the bear, quote, busted through like The Shining.
Yes, referring to that scene of Jack Nicholson when he puts his face through the wall after breaking a hole in there. Because just watching him break through there, it was really reminiscent of that. But I imagine he's a lot friendlier. Instead of running away, or instead of running towards you, he'll run away, or at least I would hope.
Now, the million-dollar question here is, of course, was there any weed in these dumpsters? I mean, is that what the bear was after?
Unfortunately, no. I imagine he could probably smell something from the shop, but as far as the dumpster goes, we don't have any cannabis products in there.
How often do you see bears hanging around the Bud Depot?
You know, not too often over the past couple of years I've been here. However, this month has been a change. There's been a lot more bear activity. Been taking some pictures, you know, trying to see what they've been getting up to, because there have been, from what I've seen, two bears.
So tell me about this particular bear. I understand you've given it a nickname. Tell me about that.
So I've nicknamed this bear Cheeseburger just because of all the good food he's been trying to get. So the name was fitting.
So what ultimately happened to the bear?
So actually yesterday I drove by there and there was a sighting. I saw him just chilling up there on the rock. And I stopped and just stared, and, you know, I was like, wow, still coming around, huh? Even after all these people are coming and bothering you today.
From our archives, that was Nico Garza at the Bud Depot in Colorado, talking to former As It Happens guest host Megan Williams in July of 2019.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
Listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE.